Okay, I'll start with a little bit of a lighter question. It says, what was the most inspiring moment of your life? They're asking me, getting kind of personal. I don't know if I could answer that. You know, at my age, you forget all the inspiring moments of your life already. You know, not as young as I used to be. But I will share with you one moment that I do remember. And I've never really talked about this, I don't think, in public. So you're the first. But I was always a pretty good student. I didn't get into too serious trouble here and there. You know, I did have a few things. But, you know, I did more or less, I was with the program, you know, doing what you're supposed to be doing. I graduated high school, and I was planning to continue in Beis Medrash and go to college at night. I was planning to be a lawyer. Someplace along the way, I got hijacked. But the truth is, when I was in 12th grade, I was I was very much into reading, and I read a lot of philosophical stuff, things like that, and it created certain weaknesses in me, certain questions, which I was struggling with for a little bit. That summer, after I graduated high school, I went to Eretz Yisrael as part of a program. It was a combination of learning and touring and learning Hebrew. It's an interesting program. It was actually sponsored by the Jewish agency, the Sachnut. They were trying to encourage B'nai Torah, you know, to make Aliyah. After a while, they discontinued the program. I'm not exactly sure why. If it was because they saw that many B'nai Torah were doing it anyway and they didn't need to spend money on it, or it's because they decided they did not want the B'nai Torah to make Aliyah. I'm not sure. But they did have this program. And at the end of the program, I didn't travel with the group. We had our own arrangements with a couple of my brother and a friend of ours. So we stayed an extra 2 days. And the day before I was leaving Yerushalayim, so we was all packed up, and we had this early morning taxi, you know, to the airport. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. We have a taxi coming at 4. You know, so you're really not going to go to sleep. You know, between 1 and 4. So I was wandering around the streets of Yerushalayim, just walking. And I came into this park. It was a very clear night. And you see, there was a moon was out. You see the moon and the stars. You can see the outlines of some of the mountains. Yerushalayim, it says, Harim Sovivla. I remember being moved at that point, you know, the idea that we talk about, Su'umara Menechem, that there's a creator, there's such a... It was at whatever, maybe I was sleep-deprived also. I'm not sure what it was. But I just remember it had made such a powerful roshim on me. Like, after that, I really had no doubts. All these doubts that had bothered me, you know, when I was in 12th grade, were kind of dispelled. It was almost like you felt it, you could touch it, you see it b'nayim. So, you know, sometimes people do go through tekufas where they have questions, they have doubts, and sometimes it takes something to get them out of it. But don't get too perturbed by it. You could end up pretty good. So I got some very fundamental questions here. I figure maybe we'll start from the most basic questions and work our way up. So, but a few people that I'm not getting, there's a huge stack here, Rabos. I can't get to all the questions. I apologize in advance if I don't get to any of your questions. You just have to invite me back. I mean, that's, we'll have to see. A few people asked basically the fundamental question, what is the goal of life? Why are we put on this earth? Or to sort of paraphrase the Mesillas Yesharim, that you know, the you saw the Chassidus Shoshu Avoda Tmima is Lis Boravis Amis Etzo Machavas Balama. What's your obligation? What does Hashem want from us? And there's a general answer and a specific answer. The general answer, as explained in many sources, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us to give us the opportunity to earn a connection, a reward to the Kadosh Baruch Hu. To give us things without earning it doesn't work. There's a busha involved in it, there's an embarrassment involved in it. We have to earn it. The Kadosh Baruch Hu gives us the opportunity to earn it. We're placed in this world in order to develop a relationship, if you will, with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, to follow his Torah, to follow his mitzvahs, and to perfect ourselves as much as we can. Our real goal in life is to take who we are and make it better. My tagline is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not put us here to be good. He put us here to be better. Better than we used to be. And that's the key to life is to grow. Sometimes people get hung up. I can't be perfect. I can't do everything. It's no use. Because Prabhupada didn't say that. You could do more than you're doing now. Don't tell me what you're doing today is the absolute maximum of what you can do in your life. You could tell me that if you want. I won't believe you. You can do better. So do a little bit better. Not much, just a little. Then the next day a little. You'd be surprised how much that adds up. And that's really the ultimate, I think, attitude that we have to have in life, you know, to improve. I actually just mentioned it in the Beis Medrash Vat, but I'll repeat it here in the high school Vat. Rosh Hashiva Zatzal has, I think, a classic shmooze on this area. In the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, the Pasuk says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared, you know, the dream with the ladder, everyone knows the dream with the ladder. What does Hashem right there? He introduces himself. So what does he say? Ani Hashem Elokei Avraham Velokei Yitzchak. So Rashi asks the question, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not miyachet shemo al tzadikim b'chayehem. He doesn't say Elokei while the person's still alive. Why? Because a person has Bechira and maybe he'll become a Rasha. How would it look that Hashem's name is associated with a Rasha? I remember when I was still in Florida many years ago, they had this big public ceremony naming some road or bridge or whatever for some retired politician. And then 3 days later, he was indicted for corruption and fraud. Ended up going to jail, and they quietly changed the name. So it could be embarrassing. So why did he say the K Yitzchak? So Rashi says Yitzchak was blind, he was confined to his house, and he was old. Rashi actually doesn't say it, but other people say it. And he's not going to sin. So there was no danger in saying Elokei Yitzchak. At this stage of his life, he was such a big tzaddik, and he worked so hard, he's faced with so few temptations, so he's not going to sin, so it's okay. At the end of the parsha, Yaakov is talking to Lavan, and he says, Lulei Elokei Avi Avram Pachad Yitzchak. He doesn't say Elokei Yitzchak. So Rashi comments, why does he say Pachad Yitzchak, not Elokei Yitzchak? Because Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Miyachet Shema Tzaddikim B'chayayim. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it. Yaakov Nisiyare Lomar Ken. Yaakov was afraid. So the Taz asked the question, why is Yaakov afraid? Hashem did it, so what are you afraid of? He says, Yaakov was afraid there would be a violation of Kibbut Avaim. Because if I say Elokei Yitzchak, I'm implying that Yitzchak isn't growing anymore. Because he doesn't have any more challenges, and he has no more Nisyonos, so he's not growing. That's an insult. What's life all about if not growing? So you're calling Yitzchak a walking dead man. Not keep it up. So Shiva, that's how pointed out, okay, but look at the other side of the picture. You're giving him the title of like, hey, Yitzchak. Only three people in the history of the world earned such a title. It's Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't earn that title. David HaMelech didn't earn that title. So it's the biggest compliment. Yaakov was still afraid. He wasn't sure. It's a huge compliment, but it's also, so really what life is about is growing. There is a little more complex, if you will, added part of it, which is how do you grow? How do you serve Hashem? What do you as a particular individual human being do? Not everyone does the same thing. And there are many, many different ways. Every person is a unique individual. You know what they say? Just remember that you are unique, just like everybody else. But every person is unique and different. That is a harder question to answer. We don't get nevuos. We don't get prophecies to tell us exactly what we should do. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us guidance anyway. And the Gra says it's kind of like Ruach HaKodesh, that if a person tries sincerely to make decisions, HaKadosh Baruch Hu plants the right thoughts in your head, so you should make the right decisions. So you have to struggle with the process, and Bez Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will guide you. You know, you have years to go yet till you have to, you know, you're still in school, so, you know, your decisions are not necessarily, you know, as broadly divergent, but Bez Hashem, even in school you have to make decisions, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help you in terms of the specifics. But your job is to make sure that you grow. Why do we keep on, there's a few questions along these lines about davening. Why do we keep on davening if we don't get an answer? It makes it seem like you're talking to no one. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. The Anshei Knesset HaGedolah were misakein specific Nusach HaTfilah three times a day. And it can get kind of routine. You know, people say the same thing over three times a day, every day. So we unfortunately have an expression that when you say something really quickly without thinking about it, we say you daven it up. What are we telling you with that expression? That people daven, they don't think about what they're saying, and they just go through the words. It's like a tape recorder. So that's a very unfortunate expression. And it's a challenge. I'm sure the Anshei Knesset knew that they were creating this challenge. But on the other hand, if you don't have this structure of having to daven three times a day, you may not daven at all. It goes on with life, and you keep on, you know, you're busy and do things, and you never think of a Kodesh Baruch Hu even once. At least if you have to come and daven, maybe you will. There are different aspects to it, but I think one of the most important things that we need to understand is that the biggest beneficiary of the tefillah is us, not necessarily because we get an answer, you know, to our tefillahs, which we may or may not get, but because how it affects us. They're after me in New York. How does it affect us? So, for example, by davening to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, it maybe gives us an opportunity to think about a Kodesh Baruch Hu and to pay attention, not just go through life routinely. It makes us understand that we're dependent on the Kodesh Baruch Hu. If we ask a Kodesh Baruch Hu for life, for health, for parnasa, it makes us realize, you know, it's a Kodesh Baruch Hu who gives us the health and the parnasa. So tefillah can be a growth experience for ourselves. We were talking about growing before. And in terms of the answer, every tefillah has an impact. The Gemara tells us in Brachas, I actually have to thank Rabbi Pesach Kron for the fact that I know which daf it is in Brachas. Daf Lamed Beis Amud Beis. I usually don't remember the blot number, but I once heard him speak about a different Gemara in the same Amud, and he was on Tefillah, and he was carrying on. Lamed Beis is Lev. Lev is heart, and the Tefillah is all about heart, and the Gemara about Tefillah is in Brachas Lamed Beis. And he was going on and on. Now I remember that the Gemara is on Lamed Beis. But the Gemara says that if a person is mispalel, marach b'tefilaso, and mispalel sincerely, it's not turned away empty-handed. Hashem does not turn away empty-handed. Four or five lines later in the same Gemara, it says, "Hamispalel v'lo nene." If you daven and you weren't answered, "Yachser v'yispalel." Daven again. Shenemar, "Kaveh el Hashem, chazak v'yamet zibecha v'kaveh el Hashem." Kaveh Hashem is interpreted to mean davening. You're not answered. Chazak v'yamet zibecha, strengthen yourself and daven again. And they said, maybe that was not an Eis Ratzon, this is. So 1 second, you just said that you're not turned away empty-handed. Now you're telling me, Nispal v'lo nene? I think the explanation is obvious. You're not turned away empty-handed, but it doesn't mean that your tefillah is answered. Tefillah answered means you get what you ask for. That doesn't always happen. Shem could have cheshbonos. You don't get what you ask for, you could try again. Maybe that wasn't an Eis Ratzon, this will be an Eis Ratzon. But something happens. The tefillah helps in some way or another. So a person should never feel, even if they daven for a particular thing and they don't get what they're asking for, they shouldn't feel that their tefillah was wasted. So tefillah does have an impact. And Kodesh Baruch Hu created the world that way. He created it so that, sort of the mashal I saw, a very good mashal, is like a lot of times, you know, a parent is trying to train a child, you know, to a certain basic thing. So the child asks for something. So the parent will say please. So the kid says, please, and then you give it to him. So did you give it to him because the kid said, please? The parent gave it to him because they wanted to give it to him anyway. So why did they make him say, please? Because they're trying to train him. He needs to learn how to say, please. Be polite. So Kodesh Baruch Hu wants to give us these things, but he wants us to ask first because that creates that relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. So I'll give it to you, but first ask. So tefillah has a power, but not that... But a Kodesh Baruch Hu, it's not that Kodesh Baruch Hu is being forced into it, so to speak. Kodesh Baruch Hu wants to help us. He loves us. But it's for our benefit that we should ask first. We should be mispalel. We should develop that relationship. So and hopefully, again, I know it is hard to always have kavan and always think about things in davening, but at least we should do it sometimes, as I said before. If you have problems in this area, fine, but do it a little better than you used to. There's a story brought down, I believe it's in Sefer Cheshvan HaNefesh, that there were two friends who were Mitzuyanim, outstanding Talmidim in Yeshiva. One of them became one of the Gedolei Hador, and the other one ended up losing his sanity. And somebody once asked him, you were two friends, you were the same, like, how did this happen? So he said, you know what? My friend was a takif, a very strong-minded person, and we decided together we wanted to perfect our davening. So he decided he's going to daven perfectly. And he was forcing himself down perfectly and couldn't do it. You know, he'd get distracted, thoughts came into his head, he'd get really angry, and he pushed himself even harder. And finally, he pushed himself so hard that he cracked. But I took a different approach. I said, I want my davening to be perfect, but I don't think I could do that today. But I'll tell you what I can do. The first bracha of Shmoneh Esrei and Shacharis, I'm going to really put a special effort into to daven with kavanah and not be distracted. I did that for about a month until I really had it down cold. And then I said, okay, now I'm going to add the first bracha of Shmoneh Esrei and Mincha. And little by little, that's what he did until over a period of years, he got to the point that he was able to daven with kavanah. So the key is, like I said before, take steps, move in the right direction. Okay. There are a number of questions. Why do we learn Gemara? I'm interpreting the question a little differently. Not why so much why do we learn Gemara, why do we learn so much Gemara? I think most people ask this question, why the Gemara? It'd be okay if we had 45 minutes a day of Gemara, they would live with that. But Gemara is like the main thing. Why is Gemara so important? And why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu just create us already knowing the whole Torah? You know, the Chazal, you know the story. In the mother's womb, Yitaka do know the whole Torah. The mother teaches the kid the whole Torah, and then he makes you forget it when you come out. So why do you have to do that? Let me remember it when I come out. Save all the problem. Then, additionally, why is it going to have to be so confusing? Why can't we just be one opinion? That's what we follow, and that's it. And we don't have to worry about all the machlokas and the questions and everything else. But again, there's probably a lot more to be said about this than I'm going to be able to say in a relatively short session, but I do want to get to other questions as well. But I think one of the most fundamental, important concepts here is that, yes, the Gemara was difficult, and it wasn't an accident. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, and he gave us the Torah, and Hashem, he made sure how things were going to work out, and he wanted it to be difficult. That's the first thing you need to know. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't somebody fouled up and made the Gemara so difficult. It was intended to be difficult. It was on purpose. Why? Do you know why? Because the growth in Torah comes from amelus. It comes from effort. When you exert effort to try to understand something, that becomes a part of you. Torah has to become a part of you. It's not just pieces of information that you know. If you knew the whole Torah, just because you were born that way and you knew the whole Torah, the Torah would not change your life that much. But if you acquire the Torah through effort and amelus, that makes you into a more Torah-dicker person. And that means the Torah values become part of you. The Torah's way of thinking becomes part of the way you think. And you develop what we call today Das Torah. What really it is you begin to think a little bit more like a Kadosh Baruch Hu. I will tell you a non-scientific story. But I believe the conclusion is true anyway. I have a brother, an older brother. He's actually a lawyer, but he went to graduate school in psychology for it. He was thinking of becoming a psychologist. He went to Brooklyn College graduate school. And he had a course on testing, different types of testing that psychologists do. One of the tests they do is called the Wechsler. I don't know if they still use it, but that was a popular test. The Wechsler is an individually administered IQ test. It's the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale, and it measures all different aspects of thinking, all different kinds of thinking skills. It takes about 3 hours to administer the test. It's one-on-one. As part of the course, he had to practice administering the Wechsler. So how do you get somebody to sit with you for 3 hours so you could practice administering a test? So you go to your brother. So I said, okay. So I took this Wechsler test that my brother administered. So in general terms, the test is divided into two segments. One of them is more what we would call thinking skills, Havana, cognitive skills. The other one is more perception. Like in the perception skills, they would show you a picture and you had to see what was missing, in the picture. Or they gave you a sequence of pictures and you had to put it in an order that would tell a story. or you had shapes that you had to, little shapes that you had to put into a different shape. All kinds of things are perceptual skills. Apparently, statistics show that most people are within a certain range. They may be stronger in one area than another, but it's only up to a certain amount. The gap is not humongous. When you find a humongous gap within the sections or even within the subsections, that's a clue that the psychologists use to determine that there might be some emotional problems. There's something blocking you in this area or whatever it might be. So I took this test and I scored way higher on the cognitive section, the thinking section, than the perceptual section, which I could have told them without the test. So when my brother was presenting the results in the classroom, so one of the students said, oh, so maybe this person has emotional problems because you see such a wide disparity. So I'm not saying I didn't have emotional problems, but the professor said to my brother, he said, one second, is the person who took this test, is he one of those rabbinical students? And my brother said, yes. He says, oh, I get that all the time. The rabbinical students always score way higher on the cognitive than the perception. I think their Talmudic training advances their thinking skills. So it really makes you think better, think differently. And this professor in Brooklyn College noticed this pattern. Now, he didn't conduct a formal experiment with a control group and this and other factors, so I can't say that it's scientifically conclusive, but I think it's absolutely true. And that amelus makes you grow into a better person, greater person. So it is hard. There's another thing you need to know. I told the story to the Beis Medrash too. Maybe we should just have one session. I don't know. So in terms of the schar of Talmud Torah, the ikar schar is also for the amelus. And if a person struggles to try to understand the Gemara, to understand the Rashi, or to understand the Tosfos, and he was not successful, and at the end of the day, he spent an hour on it, he still didn't understand the Tosfos, he gets full schar for amelus b'Torah, even though he didn't figure out pshat. It's not how it works in the secular world. Gemara tells us, Anu amelim, and they ask the question, what do you mean? People get paid in the secular world. He says, yeah, but you don't get paid for effort. You get paid for results. If you hire a tailor to make a suit for you, and you go into the shop and he measures you and he orders the material and he cuts the material and he sews the material and does everything for to make this beautiful handmade suit, and then it burns up in a fire and he doesn't deliver the suit to you, you don't pay him. But I did all the work. Yeah, but you didn't give me a suit. That's how it works in this world. But you work hard to figure out pshat and tosis, and you get paid. I learned this lesson in a very dramatic way from one of the biggest mistakes I ever made in my educational career. I'll share it with you. It was here in Toras Chaim, and I almost destroyed the entire yeshiva. You may not be here today, but we were able to recover from that mistake. What happened? In the early years of Yeshiva Toras Chaim, we had a very hard time getting our high school going. We had a Toras Emes Elementary School. We didn't have a separate middle school then, but we ran 7th through 12th grade in one building. And there was a strong culture in Miami that you're supposed to send your kids out of town for high school. That was the big feeling everyone had. So half the class or more, after 8th grade, would leave to go out of town, and then you only had a few kids left. And then it wasn't so geschmack with just a few kids. And then by 10th grade, a couple more kids left. And sometimes by 11th grade, we didn't have a class anymore. And it was very hard. We had a class coming up out of 6th grade, going into 7th grade, 18 kids in the class, a big, nice-sized class. And we had a legitimate chance of getting every one of them, each one of them, to stay. None of them had strong allegiances to Stafka and Atan Yeshiva. They were all families that were open to the idea. And this was our chance. If we could turn this class around, it'll change the whole tone of the city forever. So we knew we had to do a really good job with this class and make sure that they wanted to stay in 9th grade. So many of the parents were very concerned, maybe the kids too, very concerned about their secular education. We had a superstar teacher on the staff. He was by far our best teacher. So I assigned him to the 7th grade to teach English and social studies at half the English courses with this superstar teacher. So Rabos Machshavos Belevish. Nebuch, unfortunately, the man got killed in a car accident in October. I remember this day vividly. He didn't show up for work. And the principal, the secular principal, was a personal friend of his, all worried. It's not like him. He never misses. He's so conscientious. And if he had a miss, he would have called. Something terrible has happened. I said, don't get so paranoid, worked up. Who knows? Maybe got stuck in traffic. You know? No. Stuck in traffic this long, it can't be. So he ended. I said, after a while, the guy's agitated. So I said, call his house, see what's doing. He called the house just when the police arrived at the home to tell his wife what had happened. So it was really, really a very difficult thing. But then we had to get another teacher. So I got a resume, we advertised, I got a resume, a guy who played basketball for one of the big colleges, I don't remember which one anymore, and he was like second team All-American. He was drafted by the Milwaukee Bucks in the NBA. He didn't make the team. He spent the next year playing professional basketball in Italy. And then he was invited to the Phoenix Suns, Phoenix basketball, and he didn't make the team there either. On his resume, as personal references, he had the coach of Milwaukee and the coach of Phoenix. His resume. Meister, he didn't have any teaching experience. He had a degree, but no experience, and I didn't really interview him. But the guy I hired had a lot of experience. He turned out to be a nasty, burnt-out, miserable guy. The kids hated him. The parents hated him. And I hated him. And we're stuck with this teacher. I was afraid to fire him and try to get a third teacher in the middle of the year. I didn't know it was going to work. I said, we're just going to have to tough it out till the end of the year. It was a disaster. At the end of the year, I was summoned to a meeting. The parents arranged this meeting at somebody's house. We came to the meeting, and they laced into us, you know, about the teacher. And okay. Fortunately, it happened in seventh grade and not in eighth grade. If it would have happened in eighth grade, it would have been over. We would have lost the class. I don't know where Torah Chaim would be today. We were able to recover in eighth grade. First of all, we made a very good hire that year in eighth grade. We hired a fellow by the name of Rabbi Mordechai Palgan to be the assistant principal. And he did a good job with those eighth graders. And what? A few years later, the right way. So that was and we had a good year in eighth grade. And Baruch Hashem, we did keep most of the class, and Taka turned around. But I was thinking afterwards, this basketball player, he obviously was tremendously talented. You're not drafted by the NBA if you're not a good player. You have to be super terrific. But you're not going to make it at that level just by having talent, because there are other people out there with talent too. The only way you could get to the point that you're drafted by the NBA and given two chances to make an NBA team is, besides the talent, you had to work very hard. You had to practice for thousands of hours over the years. You had to do training, you know, endurance training, weightlifting, building up the muscles, the stamina, running, whatever they do. You put in work hours and hours and hours and hours. For years and years and years and years, it probably started in high school. You're probably doing this for 6 years, maybe more. And then there's some other guy who's just a little bit better than you, who is sitting on the bench in the Phoenix Suns, making, I don't know what, $1.2 million a year. And you're applying to teach social studies in Yeshiva Torah Chaim. And you didn't even get the job. That's Haim Amelim Ve'en Mekab Meskar. All the work that he put into that basketball, and he has nothing to show for it. Now, I should have hired the basketball player. What was I so afraid of? He wouldn't be a good teacher? The guy I got also wasn't a good teacher. But everyone hated him. They wouldn't hate this guy. I would tell him, listen, if the kids get antsy, go out to the court, show him a few moves. And this guy who knows what he could do. You think the kids are going to be complaining to their parents about this teacher? Maybe they won't be learning anything, but who's going to know? So I would have gotten away with it. And next year I'll get a teacher. If he's a good teacher, you keep him. If he's not a good teacher, you'll get somebody else. It was such a big mistake. I don't know what I was thinking. I should have hired the basketball player. But okay, we survived anyway. But the idea is, Rabosai, there's schar for the amelos. There's schar for the effort. And it's the amelos that makes you grow. So of course, Gemara is hard. But the reward is great. The reward for the amelos in Shemayim and the effect that it has on you. It makes you into that much better person. shouldn't we embrace technology? Isn't it the reality of our times? It is the reality of our times, but it doesn't mean we should embrace it. I heard a good mashal. Suppose somebody is an exterminator. That's his job. You know, he gets rid of, you know, bugs and you know, whatever the and he uses these poisonous chemicals to exterminate. So what do? They put on these gloves. Right, you have to fumigate an indoor space. So you put on gloves, you put on a mask, you know, and you do it. If you're careless with this stuff, you could get sick. Right? You could cook. But you do it for panasa, so what do? You wear the gloves, you put on the mask, and you do it. It's dangerous. The internet is an extremely dangerous place. Does it have positives? Of course it has positives. That's why it's so dangerous. Because it is needed today. Like, you can't really run a business today without some type of internet for the most part. Right? I'm sure the yeshiva office has internet. You know, our yeshiva in Queens has internet in the office. Because that's what you need to do today to run a business. But it's dangerous. So you're dealing with dangerous chemicals. You don't start playing around with it and, you know, we'll have some fun. Then I'll spray it here, spray it there, see what I could do, you know, see how long I could spray it into this space and see how long I could hold my breath, see if I die or not. You don't do that. You got to be careful. See, the internet is an effective tool to do anything, including every kind of avera in the world. And often you hear people talking about pornography and arayas on the internet, which of course is a very serious issue, but that's not the only thing. What about Lashon Hara? Right. When Donald Trump wants to tweet Lashon Hara, he's telling Lashon Hara to millions of people. In the old days, you could never do that. The best you could do is tell Lashon Hara to a few people. Then they invented the telephone, so you could call more people and tell more Lashon Hara. But, you know, you had to be near a telephone. If you're not near a telephone, you couldn't do it. So then we have cell phones, so your phone comes with you. So now we have WhatsApp. You could tell Lashon Hara to a whole bunch of people at once. And if anybody in your WhatsApp group wants to tell Lashon Hara, you'll hear it. So if you have 30 people in your group, so you instantly tell Lashon Hara to 30 people, and any one of those 30 people wants to speak Lashon Hara, you're going to hear it. In the old days, he might tell you one guy, and then he wouldn't tell you. So look how much Lashon Hara you have because of it. Like Sonas, how much time it takes up, how much waste of time there is. I once heard a presentation from a fellow who's a businessman, and he dumped his smartphone. I said, not for religious reasons. So I'm not that religious. He says he actually ran a business with a partner. His partner did it first. I don't know what motivated his partner to do it. But his partner was hacking him, telling him, you know what, you're going to be much more efficient without your smartphone. Not without internet, by the way. Without your smartphone. So what are you talking about? I travel, I drive, I have the thing with me. So I'm telling you, you'll see. So he pushed and pushed and pushed. He said, okay, I'm going to try it. So what happened? In a very short period of time, all his clients began to know that he didn't have a smartphone. And if they emailed him, he wasn't necessarily going to answer them right away. So he didn't have this expectation. You're a slave. You get the email, you have to answer right away. The guy's going to have time to send you. And you're in the middle of driving your car and you can't solve the problem anyway. You have to wait till you get back to the office. So what do you have to do? You have to stop, email him, and say, okay, when I get back to my office, I'll take care of it. And then maybe he's happy with that answer. He's not happy with that answer. Now, everyone knows when he gets to his office, he'll see the emails and he'll take care of it. When he emails him back, I took care of the problem. People are very happy. They enjoyed it. They liked it. So you have to wait a few hours. He said he didn't realize how much time he was wasting just surfing news. He didn't admit to doing anything wrong on the smartphone. So I'll believe him. But I spent time surfing the news, surfing the sports. It freed up hours a day playing games. He mentioned the name of some game. I don't remember what he said, but the whole audience laughed. So I think that means everyone knew which game he was talking about. That he ended up spending time in the game. He says he came home. His kids used to complain. He comes home. He's on the phone the whole time, and he doesn't pay any attention to them. Now he says he didn't come home so early because he's running a business. You have long hours. But at least when he came home, he spent time with his kids. He spent time with his wife. He said, it was a different life. But nothing religious. besides the nisyonos and everything else. So yes, technology is here to stay, and it's going to keep on developing, and there's nothing that we could do to stop it. But we should never lose sight of how dangerous it is, and we should never lose sight of the need to protect ourselves. As we say in Queens, kol ha-memayit harei zem mishubach. Whoever could do less is praiseworthy. The less you have to do with the internet, the better it is. It happens to be, I mentioned, I give a shir in Queens, Sunday morning shir to Baal Batim, on Navi. It's on the internet. It's video. They put it on the TorahAnytime.com internet site. By the way, I hate their slogan. They have a slogan, TorahAnytime.com, God's reason for the internet. I don't know about that. I think the slogan should be TorahAnytime.com. If you're going to have the internet anyway, at least you might as well learn some Torah too. I think that's a much better slogan, more accurate. But we weren't sure. I wasn't sure whether I should allow it. We discussed it on Holland. We weren't sure. We asked the Shaya to Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. So Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky said to me, do you know how many shmuzin from Rav Matisyahu against the internet are on the internet? It's a funny answer. But then he said like this, the yeshiva shouldn't do it. But if it's a third party, you know, nobody's going to get internet because your shir is on Torah anytime. It's like thousands shir anyway. So once, people are there anyway, you might as well have the Torah. Like I said, if you're with me on internet anyway, you might as well at least learn something also. So he said we should allow it. But Lemaisa, so it's always a challenge. What do you do? What do you allow? What you don't allow? But we need to understand. The key is we need to understand that it's dangerous. And it's dangerous in so many different ways. It could absorb people, waste their time. It could get you into nisyonos with pornography. It could get you into nisyonos with lashon hara, with leitzanos, with bad attitudes, with all kinds of motzi shemra, all kinds of things, foreign ideas and thoughts. There's so much things on the internet that are dangerous. So we have to be very careful. And that's the reason why we don't embrace it. We're stuck with it. We deal with it. But we're not happy. All right. Define Musr, and why is it so important? Actually, it says, why is it important? I added in so. I guess Musr is a subject. There are many aspects of Musr, but the fundamental definition of Musr is, the Musr is that part of the Torah that directly addresses the fundamental areas of life, what our obligations of life are, Yiras Hashem, Midos, the things that make us who we are. So it's Torah, but Torah has a lot of things in it. If you look in the Mesis Hasharim, when he talks about Zahiras and the way to acquire Zahiras, he says it in like 1.5 lines. It's very brief, but it's so, you saw this there. He says that by Torah, maybe the Zahiras, he says there's a Derech Klal and a Derech Prat. Derech Klal, any Torah brings you to Zahiras. As we said before, you learn Torah, particularly about Melus, it becomes part of you, you grow, you become a greater person. But certain parts of Torah are directed more specifically at these areas. He particularly talks about Onesh there, Sarva Onesh, other things. So those things, those parts of the Torah that particularly address your growth, we gave that title, we call that Musa. And that itself covers many different areas. It talks about Midos, it talks about Bitachon, it talks about Yiras Hashem, Yiras Onesh. It talks about Godless Adam and your potential, all these areas that directly who you are and what you could accomplish. And it's important because it's a much more direct tool to help a person grow. And to just generically allow Torah to make you grow generally isn't sufficient. More than generally, universally isn't sufficient. And therefore, we need to have that specific focus. How you do it, what you do it, there are different ways, different aspects to it, there's different levels. But in essence, that's what Musr is. And in truth, at different ages, a person can appreciate it more. The fact of the matter is, I'm going to sound like an old man again, but okay, I am, I'm allowed to. You guys, we have here a range, I imagine, of 9th grade to 12th grade. I think you'll have to admit, maybe the ninth graders won't admit it, but I think the 12th graders will. They will admit that they are probably more mature now than they were as ninth graders. And it's reasonable to assume that in 4 years from now, they'll be more mature than they are now. It takes a certain amount of maturity to face these issues and to grow. And not that ninth graders don't have maturity too, but not as much. So, you know, I don't know what exactly your curriculum is, but I think Musar becomes more effective as you get older. It's very interesting, actually. Rabbi Yisrael says the most effective age for Musar is the age of 18 to 24. That's what he says. Why? Because you have enough maturity to tackle these issues with a seriousness, but the habits aren't as deeply ingrained as you go on in life. When you go in life and you've lived your life a certain way for a number of years, the habits are very deeply ingrained. They're very hard to get rid of. So it's harder to get rid of things when you've been doing it for so long. But on the other hand, when you're younger, it's harder to approach it as seriously. So you may or may not believe that, but the fact of the matter is, as you get older, Musar will become even more effective. But that's really what Musar is and why it's so important. Let's see if we can squeeze in another question or two. Why did Hashem have to make us have desires? Wouldn't the whole world be a lot better with not as many averis? And even if our goal in this world is to learn Torah, we could still learn Torah without doing averis. So, in light of what I said earlier, our goal in this world is to actually grow and overcome those challenges. Without challenges, without the Yetzirah, without the desires, then there's no growth. So that's why Kadosh Baruch Hu created the Yetzirah, and with that, we have that opportunity to overcome that Yetzirah and to grow. If he created without a Yetzirah, then there's no schar, there's no growth, there's no accomplishment. It's just who you are. And sort of a little mashal that can illustrate it for us. I think we all probably come across this. There are people with different personalities. Right? Everyone has different personalities. There are some people who are maybe have a tense personality, they're easily could easily lose their temper. And the other people who are really laid back and chilled out and nothing seems to bother them. And it's not because they learned Musar, it's not because they worked on themselves, it's just the way they are. So for that chilled out, laid back person, it's not necessarily such a big temptation not to lose his temper. So if he doesn't get angry and somebody, you know, does something wrong to him, that might not be much of an accomplishment. That's just the way he is. This other guy who's a little bit trigger happy and he controls himself and doesn't get angry, he has a tremendous scar. Now don't worry. The guy who's chilled out and laid back has other challenges in life. Maybe he doesn't, it's hard for him to get up out of bed in time for minyan. Lying around, let's say another hour. The other guy is on the trigger, he's out of bed anyway. Comes to minyan. So this guy's a different nisayon. This guy, he might have jealousies, he might have other things, laziness. Nobody is created perfect, but people are created with pluses and minuses. So that's the Yetzer Hara. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu needed to give us the Yetzer Hara so that we can have that opportunity to fight it and grow. And even if sometimes we lose those battles, in the aggregate picture, it's worth it. And a person, I'll just end with a thought I saw in the name of Rav Volbi. I shared it once with Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal, and he agreed with the concept. I could tell, he didn't say beferish, I could tell that he didn't necessarily think that that was shot in the Medrash. But even so, I'll say it over the Medrash the way Rav Volbi said it. The Pasuk said, in Navi says, Sheva yipo tzadik v'kam. A tzadik falls down 7 times and gets up. One of the places in the Medrash says, Zu milchemes hayetzer. This is the battle with the Yetzer Hara. So Rav Volbi said, so here you have a guy, he's fighting the Yetzer Hara, and 7 times he loses, and 1 time he wins. Right? Shevel yipol tzadik v'kam. What do you call a guy like that? A guy who's battling the Yetzer Hara and loses 7 out of 8 times. What would you call him? I think I would call him a Rasha. What does the Pasuk call him? A tzadik. How could you be a tzadik if you're losing the battle to the Yetzer Hara 7 times out of 8? How can you call such a person a tzaddik? And Rav Volbe explained, we know that the more difficult the challenge is, the less the onesh, and the greater the reward is for overcoming that challenge. Lefum tzara agra. So what happens? You're faced with a challenge and it's difficult, and you fail. Okay, you tried. It's not as if you just gave in. You tried, you failed. That's a chait, and it's a failure, and it counts against you. And you do that 7 times. But one time you win. That was a difficult victory. That's an amazing accomplishment. It's very possible that that one victory is a greater mitzvah, a greater schus than all those 7 failures put together. It doesn't say you're a tzaddik gomer, but you're a tzaddik. By winning that 1 time out of 8, that battle, you're ahead of the game. Because to put it mathematically, maybe each one of those losses is like 10 points against you, but that victory is 200 points for you. So it's 200 to 70. That's a tzaddik. So we have to understand that even though the Yetzer is challenging and we may feel that we fail sometimes, and maybe we even feel that we fail a lot, but if we succeed every so often, who knows? Maybe we're a tzaddik. Wouldn't it be annoying to go through life, through your whole life, thinking you're a Rasha and you're really a tzaddik all along? So don't be so negative. It could be that we don't know, only Kodesh Baruch Hu knows. But so it's important to keep that perspective. So yes, the Yetzer Hara is there. Yes, he gets us from time to time. But as long as we're in the fight, you know what? If a person even delays the Yetzer Hara, it's a schus, it's a mitzvah. The Yetzer is trying to get you to do an Avera, and you resist, but you end up doing the Avera, but you didn't do it right away. You did it 20 minutes later. That's 20 minutes of resisting the Yetzer Hara. Every minute that you resist the Yetzer Hara is a tremendous schus. Okay, one time you were nichshol. You failed. You had 20 successes. So even if a person does the Avera, but he resisted, that's also something. So stay in the fight. That's the point. Kadosh Baruch Hu gives the Yetzer Hara because they're supposed to fight it. You stay in the fight, and you'll be a winner. May Hashem should give you all siyata d'shmaya.